number two of the show. It is a minute after the hour. That was quick. Quick turnaround, huh? Jay has a problem with me. I'm not talking about Jay Mariotti. I'm talking about a guy by the name of Jay Cohen. And I'll answer his email before we end affairs here tonight at 11 p.m. on the East Coast. And, of course, that's 8 p.m. out on the West Coast. So I'll get to that, Jay Cohen, and the email he sent me following the first hour of the show tonight. The other Jay is Jay Mariotti, who joins me each Wednesday night on the show to discuss a multitude of different things. And we always enjoy sitting down and discussing things with Jay and finding out what is on his mind. And again, if you've got any questions, comments, or anything else, send them my way. TalkToDino@gmail.com. TalkToDino@gmail.com. The one and only, the great Jay Mariotti from the West Coast in California is on the Dino Costa Show on this Wednesday. One more time. Hi, Jay.
What's up, Dino? Why is Jay Cohen mad at you? I know somebody named Jay Cohen.
Jay is angry at me for some words that I used in the first hour of the show tonight, and I'm going to have to address that in hour number three. I think Jay is taking things a little bit too personal, but I'll leave it at that for now. Well, who's the Jay Cohen you know?
He's a sports writer.
Sports writer?
Chicago.
Really?
I don't know. Could be the same guy.
I don't think so. Let me see here. Hold on. This is his address. I'm looking at his address right now. No, I don't think it is. I don't think it is. But anyway, we'll see.
Hey, that's the big... You don't work for Sirius anymore. You don't work in St. Louis. You don't work in Denver. You do an internet show. You can say what you want.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and so can you. And you do when you come on the show. There's a lot of things I want to get into. A lot of things I know you want to talk about, things I want to steer you in the direction of. But I want to start out with something I saw on The Last Dance. By the way, Jay, just very, again, more entertaining sports television theater. It's great. It really is. And I'm almost not looking forward to the end of it. You know, this coming Sunday night, that's gonna put a wrap on it. But it's been very entertaining. And but one of the things that I laughed at was on the last two that we saw was, of course, they went into the whole Jordan thing with him playing minor league baseball with the Birmingham Barons. And you know, look, I as I said on the show last night, I don't denigrate anything that Jordan tried to do on a baseball field. The fact that he hit 202 in a very competitive Double A league, the Southern League, where there's always a lot of talent. You know, that's impressive, you know, especially for somebody who hadn't picked up a bat or a glove for about 15 years before he started playing. But to hear Jerry Reinsdorf and then to hear, you know, Terry Francona, who was his manager that year at Double A Birmingham, say with another 1,000 at bats, you know, Michael Jordan would have been able to play with the White Sox. Are these people crazy?
Well, I think the comparison is Tim Tebow. It would have been a publicity stunt. Tim Tebow still is whiffing, what, 1 out of 3 at bats? Michael yeah. Jordan had a weak arm. He showed some talent. He could steal a base. He had those long, loping, you know, strides. But at the plate, Dino, he's trying to hit like, I don't know if you remember the name, Walt Hriniak.
Yeah.
He was a legendary hitting coach of the White Sox. And everybody had that stroke where they're just sort of striding through the plate and catching the bat. Well, they were trying to teach Michael that, and it looked kind of ridiculous. He 6'6", 210, just looked a little bit skinny to be playing baseball. That's all. And I think ultimately, I do not think he would have been worthy of a major league slot because he would have taken that slot from somebody far more deserving who had put in a lot of years to do it. So when Reinsdorf said that, that's Reinsdorf trying to pat himself on the back, trying to deflect all of those controversies about gambling and the horror of his father's murder, and that's Reinsdorf trying to look like, you know, Branch Rickey from the past or something. It's just Reinsdorf being Reinsdorf. In truth, you nailed it. Michael overachieved for one season given the circumstances, but a major league career, no.
No, I mean, he couldn't hit the curveball. He couldn't hit off-speed pitches. He struck out a lot. You know, 202 average, a weak arm. He looked like an NBA player, the greatest NBA player, masquerading in a minor league baseball uniform. And as to his ability to steal bases, he did steal 32 bases that year, but he also was thrown out 18 times. As, you know, let's not forget that.
Yeah, but I went down there for those games, and those were crazy.
Yeah?
Celebrities everywhere. I mean, they achieved what they wanted. But in the end, we're going to look back at that period of time. Wow, that year and a half, he could have been playing basketball in his prime. That's his choice. He doesn't regret it. He went on to win 3 more titles. But man, oh man, just adding to the body of work, if he had continued to play basketball.
You know who seems like a great guy in these features that we're seeing every week? And he's had a lot to say. They've gone to him quite a bit. And you covered him. So this is why I'm asking you if he's as nice a guy or as good a guy as he seems to be on these documentaries. B.J. Armstrong. B.J. seems to be a really great guy. I like when he when they show him and get some of his thoughts. Nice guy.
Yeah, and right now he's an agent, I believe, for Draymond Green. Imagine those discussions, B.J. and Draymond, after one of Draymond's flare-ups or something. But Armstrong was a Krause draftee, somebody who was drafted to assemble around Jordan. And B.J. served a purpose there. I just thought it was hilarious when Jordan, at his angriest, is waving the baseball bat around in the locker room because B.J. Armstrong had hit the winning shot in a playoff game. I mean, Jordan was ready to kill with that cigar and that bat. That was the funniest part, I thought, of the entire documentary. Why are you getting so flustered by B.J. Armstrong? And that's classic Jordan trying to find any reason to inspire and motivate himself, as if he really needed B.J. But yeah, Armstrong, decent guy, handled the circus very well. They let him go. He signed with Charlotte, and as I said, he's now a player agent.
You got to, there's a certain appreciation that I've got for Jordan being able to play these certain mind games, even if some of them were fictional, Jay. It goes to show you the lengths that he was willing to go in terms of even to find something that really wasn't there to motivate him and to push him even more. I mean, it's just it's just part of his whole DNA and his makeup, and it just speaks to his incessant drive to win at all costs. And so I don't really have a problem with that.
Well, he looked for enemies. That was his game. George Karl during the finals.
Yeah.
Former North Carolina guys. George Karl doesn't say hi. Jordan flips out. I mean, it was maniacal. It was psychotic. But again, how many of the great ones are like that? Tiger, Kobe Bryant. There aren't many.
Yeah.
Maybe back in the last century you could have found more. But as I've told you, that's what we lack today. There is so much money right out of the chute. When LeBron James leaves high school, he's got a shoe contract for multiple dozens of millions. All of these guys do. Zion Williamson. What is the motivation that Michael Jordan had back in the day when, yes, he had a Nike deal, but it was for a pittance compared to what these guys get now? Michael Jordan had to find enemies, whether it was being cut from his high school team or Dean Smith shutting him down in the four-corner offense in North Carolina, or something as silly as him telling me one day, I'm going to tape your column to my refrigerator door. What? I'm motivating you? That's what he did. He needed something, and it's a shame at the end of his career he couldn't find it, because once he went to Washington, that evaporated, Dino. He could have found every reason to hate anybody on earth. It wasn't going to matter. His body was thicker. He couldn't jump like he used to. He had no teammates around him. That was ugly. But yes, in the period of time in Chicago when I covered him, it was amazing how many enemies, real and imagined, that Michael Jordan had to feed off.
Yeah. He also, I was interested in your thoughts on when they showed, when they played Seattle, went up 3-0 in that series, and the Sonics came back and won 2 to make it a 3-2 series. And that's, we saw Gary Payton, who was on the last episode, and he said to George Karl, I don't give a shit what you say. I'm guarding Jordan. I should have been guarding him from the jump. You didn't let me do it because you didn't want me to sacrifice, exhausting myself on defense, which might affect my offense. But anyway, Payton guarded him in those 2 games, and the results speak for themselves. I mean, Jordan was not the Jordan he was in the first 3 games. And then when they said, they played the tape of Jordan, of Payton saying, that he shut down Jordan, Jordan laughed it off. And I was thinking of you at that point and what you were thinking when you saw that.
That series got gnarly. I mean, they looked like in the first 3 games, like the greatest team ever assembled. And then, and I need to inject this. I don't know if it got around the team at the time because the story did not go public, but that was when Krause was ready to fire Phil. This was in Seattle. He was fed up, and Reinsdorf invited Tim Floyd to Seattle, and Floyd came in the middle of that series. These guys can't enjoy prosperity, Reinsdorf and Krause. And I wonder, as I look back at that, if word started to get around, that's not the biggest of towns, Seattle, and Reinsdorf employed her walking around Seattle all day. I'm shocked it never got out to us, but I bet it did among the team, and I wonder if it threw them off a little bit. That said, yeah, I think Carl was wrong. Sometimes these coaches, you've seen it throughout the documentary, tie themselves into knots. How about simple logic instead of pretzel logic? And yet, you saw it there. We saw it other times. Remember that Ron Harper sequence? Craig Elo covered Jordan during the shot. Harper threw an F-bomb at Lenny Wilkins at the time. And it seems the coaches are so caught up in how to deal with Michael that they sometimes resorted to unconventional means. When you have one of the greatest defensive guards in the history of basketball on your team, let him go after Michael.
You know, one of the things that we've talked about, and Krause has been a central figure in this whole thing, and of course he's deceased, so it would be fascinating if Krause was still alive to have him be a part of this. I mean, utterly fascinating if he was still here to give his opinion on some things. But you've made mention of this. I mean, for all of the derogatory things that have been said about Krause and the breakup of the team and telling Phil Jackson before the season that that's going to be the last season, and if Michael wants to come back, he can come back, but if not, the choice is up to him. And then, you know, the contract squabbles with the Scottie Pippen. When you think about it in totality, now, when he tried to remake the team and reboot it after they won that final championship, of course it didn't work. And we can go through the litany of player personnel moves that he made that really didn't pan out. And so he was out the door a couple of years after that. But if you look at Krause's overall body of work, Jan, I think you've credited him previously when we've talked about this. He did get the kind of cast around Jordan that enabled them to win the first three. And then when you look at the final three championships that they won, really a much different team. And again, Krause was able to go out and get some guys. Kerr was on the scrap heap at that time. It was practically out of the league. He brought him in. He made the trade, decided to go forward with the trade for Dennis Rodman. Traded out Oakley for Bill Cartwright. So, Jerry Krause, for all of the bad things that are said about him, really, when you think about it, he was, I think, you can argue, one of the better general managers in the NBA for most of his career running that team.
He erected the tallest building in sports and then inexplicably tore it down. That's the problem. That's the legacy.
Right.
Why, when you, on draft night, traded for Scottie Pippen, you found Horace Grant, any number of other deals, you went out of your way to scout Tony Kukoc, and the way he went about it was silly and it offended everybody, but he did find Tony Kukoc and wooed him to the United States. Not the easiest thing to do. Back then when Kukoc was dealing with a war-torn country at the time. Dennis Rodman, gambling on Rodman, finding Steve Kerr off the scrap heap to be the spot-up shooter after Paxson left. Yes, one by one, he assembled these teams. Now, again, it was Jordan maximizing that talent and Jordan, the tyrant in practice, making sure that talent was ready for the playoffs. But Krause did find the pieces. We have to give him credit for that. It's just that it's a shame he didn't have the sense of humor and the personality, as I've said, to sit back and enjoy it and just kind of laugh off Jordan and Pippen when they were mocking him. How about just saying, you know, coming back with a quick line? Instead, a very sensitive man couldn't handle it. You kind of feel sorry for him. It's just, why did you have to take it down? To this day, Dino, I wonder if that resentment toward all the mocking he was getting, if that led to Krause taking it down. I'm going to get you. I'm bigger than you. Spill, you're out of here, even if you go 82-0. See, that's kind of, it's warped thinking. You're thinking of yourself first, and that defies what he always says. Organizations come first. Well, if organizations come first, why did you allow your ego to get in the way here of at least one more championship? And if you were so brilliant, why, without Michael Jordan, did this thing just go to hell immediately? I've never seen anything like Krause, somebody who was so great and so self-destructive in one swoop. Usually we're talking about an athlete who turns to drugs or something. This was an executive who couldn't get out of his own way.
Did you ever, in the years that you were there with the Sun-Times, Jay, did you ever get an opportunity to sit down with Krause and have, you know, anything close to an extended conversation with him about this kind of stuff?
No, he had his own people. I remember Bob Ryan once telling me, Jay, I'm a member of the Jerry Club. I said, what is that? He said, I'm one of Jerry's best friends. I'm a Jerry guy. I said, so? Later, I found out that anytime Krause didn't like somebody in the media, he would poison that person to his friends in the media. Now, Ryan and I had to do a TV show for 8 years. So, obviously, we got through that, and I thought Bob was a sweetheart. I thought Bob is great. I don't think he ever held it against me. But, yes, Krause had, he was an old-school guy who felt sports writers should be part of the team, and I was once a sports writer myself. He was. And you should have been like me. And the minute he thinks you're a rat or something, he turned right on you and never gave you an opportunity. My great Krause story is Christmas Eve 2001, he decides to fire Tim Floyd on Christmas Eve. That's how the Bulls do things. I arrive in a snowstorm. The Berto Center, the practice facility, there are about 10 people there, including Floyd and his wife and his daughter, all sitting on the practice floor. Sitting on the floor, I'm wiping snow off my coat, wondering, what is going on here? And I hear him go, and you, Mr. Mariotti, you can wipe that smirk off your face right now. And I go, Merry Christmas, Jerry. And you know what? That was on television. That was a televised press conference.
Oh, no kidding.
Never heard the end of it, but that was what he thought of me. He passed away in 2017. I don't mean to make light of it. I'm just telling you Krause stories. You were either with him or you were the enemy. There was no gray area with Krause.
What are your conclusions up to this point in time, and what do you expect in the final two episodes? I mean, have you enjoyed this to the extent that you thought you would? Has it been surprising to you, revelatory in any way?
I believe it's nostalgic rehash.
Yeah.
I lived it all.
Right.
And it's been great to watch it, to see it come back. And what I never saw, or no media people ever saw, was the inner sanctum. So what we're getting to see is we went to the locker room after games, but we're not in there during halftime, during these speeches. We're, you know, this is all new to us, too. So that's been fun. And I think we're seeing the outgrowth of these personalities. Everybody is seeing it was not just Jordan. It was the brooding Scottie Pippen. It was the, you know, freak show Dennis Rodman. It was free love Phil Jackson and all of these other characters, Krause, Reinsdorf. You could not have assembled this better in a Hollywood writing room. And it made for great theater. It's just a shame we couldn't see it earlier. I'm glad this country has had a chance to see it during the pandemic. It's been healthy for people, sports fans, to actually watch a great sports team and an all-time sports figure and how he operated. I'm glad you're seeing the maniacal SOB side of Michael, because that's what made him thrive. As I've told you, I don't think they've done enough with gambling. I don't think they've done enough with politics or the lack thereof. I think it's a Michael production. It's image enhancing. He succeeded in enhancing his image for all the young people who didn't really know why he was greater than LeBron James. Now everybody knows why he was greater than LeBron James. Now what I'm hearing Dino this week is, but look at LeBron. We have yet another black male killed by two white guys in Georgia. And here's LeBron coming to the rescue in a tweet, I've had it, and being the activist, Michael never would have done this. Well, that's true. Michael never would have done it. So what that has done, Dino, is reopen the conversation of GOAT, greatest of all time. How is that defined? Can Jordan truly be the GOAT if he wouldn't take on social crises as LeBron just did last week? You know, we could argue about that for 3 weeks here and not come to a conclusion, but I'm glad LeBron reintroduced him in that sense, because he has defined himself by stepping forward during these heightened social crises in America. He did it again.
Yeah,
and then you see Jason Whitlock of Fox come out and attack
Well, LeBron, Jay, listen. For all of the activism that has been a part of LeBron over the last couple of years, I mean, what he did in that tweet, I thought was very reckless and irresponsible. I mean, I said on the show, if he would have come out and said, you know, this is a tragedy, I can't make sense of it, it's terrible. Hopefully, justice is going to be done. The thoughts and prayers to the family and the victim. And I've gone on this show, and I have said that it was an execution carried out in the middle of the street that never should have happened. And I don't want to hear excuses and theories as to why this 25-year-old guy should have been killed, because it was senseless. It was disgusting on every level. But for LeBron to come out, Jay, and to say something like, every time we come out of our homes, we are literally hunted like animals. I mean, that's beyond the pale. That's reckless. That's irresponsible.
That's also a guy who moved into his neighborhood in L.A. and immediately had to deal with racist graffiti. The thing is, the question is, as Whitlock brought up, was LeBron doing this for effect last week? And he does have a history of doing this, so you can't say he just came out of nowhere. But was he doing it for effect because of Michael Jordan dominating the American consciousness the last 3.5 weeks? I think that's a fair point for Whitlock to make. And it's amazing how Whitlock always gets in the middle of these. His show at Fox Sports gets minimal ratings, but he seems to be a Twitter monster. Whenever he seems to know exactly how to get into the craw of people when it comes to these racial issues. And it's amazing to me that you've got LeBron James and Jason Whitlock bucking horns here as this Michael Jordan documentary with very little zero social activism grinds to an end. It's a fascinating chapter right now in a pandemic.
It's Jay Mariotti with me every Wednesday, hour number two. A question, comment, a concern for Jay, talktodino@gmail.com, talktodino@gmail.com. So a story that I printed out in anticipation of your appearance again here tonight, Jay, from Yahoo Sports. I don't know if you've seen this. Headline to the piece, Scottie Pippen is reportedly unhappy about The Last Dance. Let me read a little bit of this. The much-anticipated 10-part ESPN docuseries, The Last Dance, has garnered tons of positive press for its never-before-seen coverage of Michael Jordan's final championship with the Chicago Bulls. Critics of the docuseries have noted, however, that the story is inherently biased, since the person doing the storytelling, Jordan, was also involved in the process of making it. One of the aspects that has garnered the most division among fans is the portrayal of Jordan's teammate Scottie Pippen. Pippen, who spoke candidly about his life and career, was widely considered Jordan's right-hand man when the two players for the Chicago Bulls play together, but the series takes aim at some of the disagreements between the two players, and Pippen is reportedly upset with his portrayer. In the series, Jordan says that Pippen's the best teammate he ever had, and he wouldn't have had as much success without Pippen. Yet, the series does delve into how frustrated Pippen felt about making far less than his teammates. Rumors were rampant that he might be traded to another team, and Pippen chose not to have surgery. We've talked about this, on his ruptured ankle tendon until the start of the 97-98 season. Jordan called the move selfish because it left the rest of his teammates to play several months without him. And then in the two episodes that we saw last weekend, Jay, in a later episode, the story goes on to note an incident in which Pippen sat out the final seconds of the 94 semifinals game because Coach Phil Jackson picked another player for the final play is pretty harshly criticized. And Pippen apparently still has angry feelings about what happened as well. He maintains that the situation was complex and that his feelings were and are valid. Quote, it's one of those incidents where I wish it never happened. He says, but if I had a chance to do it over again, I probably wouldn't change it. Your thoughts on that?
Whoa. He shouldn't have said that.
I agree.
I think the point to be made here is if Michael Jordan is going to lean on the director Jason Eyre to minimize the gambling and the lack of activism, then why didn't he lean on Jason Eyre to take care of Scottie? Michael pored over every nanosecond of this documentary before it went to press, so to speak. And Scottie Pippen, I remember this vividly. About 5 weeks ago, ESPN had on Scottie, who works for ESPN, to talk about this. Well, I know what it was. There was a conference call with Steve Kerr, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, and the national media about this documentary and Jason Eyre. Scottie didn't show up, and my first thought was, uh-oh, what is he upset about? And he has not really appeared on ESPN throughout any of this. You'd think he'd be a natural. He works for the company to show up on Sunday night after the documentary and talk about it at least once, right? Nope. Yeah, there's no doubt he's upset. And does he have a right to be? I don't know. I want to see the last two episodes because they keep showing his face, Dino, Pippin, when they promo the last two episodes. That tells me they're probably going to do a makeup call, so I don't want to speak about this quite yet. But as of now, through eight episodes, I don't think they have captured the entirety of Scottie Pippen. You had to cover the 1.8-second thing. You had to cover how Pippen was upset about money because it was a constant. I remember. I was part of it, and I wrote about it all the time throughout that period. But Scottie's role, and let's see if they bring this out, in those last two NBA finals, I've told you this before, I think he was as valuable, if not more so, than Michael in both of those final series against Utah. And I hope they bring that out, because right now, if I'm looking at this, I'm seeing an angry second cog, an angry Robin to Batman, not getting his due once again, sort of symbolic for his entire career, right? He never did. And yet, I would have liked to have seen more byplay, Jordan telling us what Pippen has meant to his career, and vice versa. I don't think we've had enough of that either. I can tell you this, one without the other, six championships would not have happened.
I don't think there's anyone who would disagree with that. Concerning the end of the game situation where Kukoc was given the shot and Jackson... I love that Phil was very candid when they, you know, what did you say? You know, I went over to Pippen and I said, what, you're not going into the game? Because Tex Winter told him he wasn't going to the game, and he went over to Pippen and he said, you're not going to the game? And Pippen said, no. And Jackson said, fuck him. Let's go. And Kukoc took the last shot, hit the shot, beat the Knicks in that game. Remembering what you wrote in the Sun-Times, what was it that you wrote concerning that whole episode?
What a crazy night that was. That was the same night, I believe, when there was a brawl.
oh, yeah.
The Knicks and the Bulls.
Yeah.
It spilled into the stands,
right.
I believe, right by Stern.
Yep.
and right by some very influential investors in the Bulls, including some wives who toppled over. I mean, dresses up in the air. I mean, this was insane. The entire night was insane. The game lasted forever because of the brawl. We're fighting these archaic deadlines. I remember that this is why newspapers have died. I remember getting a call from the copy desk. Where's your column? I said, the game's not over. What do you want me to write? We don't care. We're going to press. Oh, okay, well, what the hell am I supposed to write? That's a classic example of why newspapers are dying. And so what did I write when we eventually got to the final edition, however many people actually saw it?
Yeah.
I wrote that Scottie Pippen... you know, screwed up royally, maybe screwed up his legacy, and now Tony Kukoc, a guy that Pippen had mocked and ridiculed and ran over during the Barcelona Olympics, that Kukoc saved his ass. And it was the obvious column. It's just, what do I remember? I remember going out to a suburban hotel where all the national media were staying and grabbing from downtown a big stack of late sports finals and putting it in the hotel gift shop so that our final product at the Sun-Times could actually be seen by the national media members instead of that horseshit early paper that had all these incomplete stories that were embarrassing. Oddly, that's what I remember about it.
You know, with human nature being what it is, as I was watching that again and reminded of that situation, and I watched it live as it was going on, but, you know, all these years later, and I'm thinking about Pippen sitting on the bench and refusing to go into the game and insulted that he was not given the last shot by Jackson, and then Kukoc makes the shot, and Bedlam, right, in the arena, Bulls win, Kukoc is a hero. And then Cartwright, after the game, they told the story that Cartwright was in tears, you know, couldn't believe that Pippen quit on the team and left them in that position as he did. And then Pippen, I guess, said he was sorry to the group of players before the press was let in. But human nature being what it is, I was wondering, as I was watching last weekend, Jay, what Pippen was thinking. Was he hoping that Kukoc would miss that last shot? And when he made the shot, the emotions or what Pippen must have been thinking at that time, as his teammates, you know, rushed the court to congratulate Kukoc, and Pippen kind of just, you know, slowly picked up his stuff and kind of, you know, waltzed into the locker room. I wonder if Pippen was hoping he would make the shot or miss the shot.
I do know that he could not separate his bitterness about money, Dino. That's what it was about. And he was underpaid woefully, and then he had to deal with a general manager, Krause, who talked about Kukoc as the second coming and had to pay a pretty penny to Tony Kukoc, various fees to his club in Europe and so on. So Pippen, underpaid, has his boss basically tell the world, this guy is going to change basketball, Tony Kukoc. And then with Michael Gunn, Pippen had his troubles that year, but he also enjoyed a very good season. I think he was number three at MVP balloting. And I think he felt, well, if this is the succession here, then I am supposed to be Michael here with the last shot, not Tony Kukoc. I think, I don't like getting inside guys' heads, but that's pretty much what's going on. He thinks, all right, Michael's gone playing baseball. I'm the star of the team. I should get the final shot. You're giving it to this guy who's the pet of Jerry Krause, and meanwhile, you're underpaying me woefully, and you're giving him the shot. I think it all bubbled to the surface. He was still immature.
Yeah.
This is a guy who had marital problems. I told you, they found a gun in his car outside PJ Clark's restaurant. He called the fans racists at one point. That was never covered, by the way, oddly. Yeah, Pippen, as wonderful a talent as he was, and a Hall of Famer, he emerged as a Hall of Famer, one of the greatest defensive players ever, and an unbelievable passer, had these demons that were part of the story. And right there, you saw them come out at the very worst time.
That's a good way to put it. I think you summed that up very well. By the way, Mr. Rogers, as you like to call him, Scott Van Pelt, I don't know if you saw this, but he was lamenting in a newspaper story that I read yesterday. He's saying, I don't know how long I can keep doing the Sports Center with no sports to talk about. What are we going to do here? But
It was a CNN story, I think.
Oh, was it?
Actually,
okay.
I read that, and I think he came clean a little. He said, when I drive home at night, I wonder what are we doing?
Yeah.
He has bosses, Dino.
Right.
And, you know, come on. They want to keep sports alive at ESPN. They keep, let's just keep churning it out. If you read right now whatever's on their website, I think their lead story today at one point was Rams trot out new uniforms.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
That's news.
In the middle of a pandemic, that's the best you can do. LA Rams introduced new uniforms. Well, that's what they're doing. They're trying to ignore that the pandemic is existing. They're wishing it back in. Sports back into existence, and they're using Mr. Rogers to do it at night. I'm glad he's coming out and doubting this. When he gets home, he must go, how do I do this again? Because every night it's the same thing. Here come the three experts who are all, Jeff Pass and Adrian Wojnarowski and Adam Schefter at times.
Yeah.
And they're all pretty much working as servants for the leagues they cover, trying to wishful thinking back those leagues into existence. And the last couple of nights, it's been passed with Van Pelt. Van Pelt saying, look, we're getting a little tired of this. And Passan goes, no, this is good. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, what are you, a guidance counselor here? You're a baseball reporter. I don't envy them right now. They're losing their ass. Disney is just bleeding to death. And they're trying to keep the light on. They don't want to lay off hundreds, maybe thousands of people. And without sports, it's not happening. That's why I'm trying to have patience with what they do every night, because on one hand, their livelihoods depend on this, but hey, folks, you're still journalists. Let's not deceive people into, oh, baseball's coming back. We don't know that. Oh, the NBA, there's hope. We don't have it. Brian Windhorst comes on last night, one of the reporters, and pretty much says, why don't you just shut down the league? Thank you very much. I don't know if he'll get a furlough because of that or what, but at least somebody came clean there. Yeah, shut down the NBA. It's absurd to try to come back right
yeah.
now.
Brian Furlough, somebody wants to see you in human resources.
Brian Windhorst, Bob Iger wants to see you. Bob Iger, okay, last week, who has taken over the reins again at Disney. He had named his successor, but then a pandemic hit, so he's got to save Disney. Comes out last week at an earnings call, Dino, when they lose $1.4 billion in recent weeks. $1.4 billion. and he says, oh, people will rush back to our brands because we are warm and fuzzy and we bring joy and comfort. And then he throws himself behind this UFC thing last week. Dana White in classic form, not caring about a positive coronavirus test, staging his event anyway, cursing out the Showtime guy afterward. And here's Bob Iger calling it warm and fuzzy entertainment for ESPN. Sometimes you just have to sit back and laugh.
Well, it looks as though their foray into the Korean baseball organization might be short-lived, Jay, because on Monday, as you know, the owners presented the players with a plan to get the games back on the field. And not so fast, though, because a prearranged agreement that they had back in March, which said that the owners agreed that they would pay the players the prorated portion of their full salaries for however long they play. In this instance, it would be an 82-game season. The owners have now rethought that, and they've asked the players to take a pay cut over the remaining 82 games that they hope to get the baseball back. So they want to send the teams to spring training in June and start this whole thing on July the 4th. And, of course, you've got things to say about that, I'm sure.
Yeah, they're arguing about money, and that's about the last thing, Dino, anybody wants to hear.
Right.
In normal times,
right.
Fans are repulsed by this. Billionaires versus millionaires. Now, as people truly fight to survive and you know, live, baseball is fighting over money. We're really doing this during a pandemic. Shame on them. It's so typical of these owners. How about going to the players and then announcing to the public, we want baseball to come back. We're not sure we can. We're going to try to keep the players safe as possible and their families and the managers and the coaches and all the support staff. We're going to try our best. We want baseball to be a part of Americana. Again, nope. They decide, we want a 50-50 revenue split, and if not, we're going to be mad at you. And then here comes the governor of Illinois, who is aligned with who, by the way?
Jerry Reinsdorf.
The governor of Illinois comes out yesterday, rips the players apart, said, demands that they come back, and says you should not be making these huge financial demands. They aren't making any financial demands. The union and the owners came to an agreement in March about any sort of prorated salary that would go into effect during a pandemic shortened season. So now there's this proposal for 82 games starting in July. The union is saying, wait a minute, we have already negotiated this, and the owners are saying, no, we're coming back to the table because we're not going to have any fans in the stands, and 40% of our revenues are from game nights. Well, Dino, as you know, the owners have never, ever opened their financial books to the players, and the players don't believe that 40% figure, nor do I, because the bulk of revenues comes from media deals, not from game nights. Everybody knows that. I'd say that figure is closer to 20% game nights, but see, you got lying involved again. The owners can't get away from themselves in their lying. You have Mark Teixeira go on ESPN, which has a vested interest in this, and he rips the players apart, even though Teixeira, I think, made about $300 million during his major league career, but he's telling the players, do it for America. Wait a minute. The owners and the players should be doing it for America, Dino. I don't think the players should be the only ones bearing the financial brunt here. After all, they are bearing the health risks of going back. The owners aren't going onto the field. They're going to be sitting in their caves, their virus-protected caves, talking to their accountants. I mean, come on. What is wrong with these owners? So any momentum I had about baseball coming back, I lost it when the once again, we're talking about labor issues in a sport that has way, way too many problems and existentially to be talking about money right now.
Well, no matter how you view it, and no matter which side you find more sympathy for with the situation, I think that, you know, as I told my audience last night when I was detailing this, Jay, I think that for as much optimism, and, you know, baseball fans all over America, okay, great, we're going to get the games back, and start in July and, okay, we'll take this truncated season and it's going to be bizarre and it's going to be unnatural and it's going to be unprecedented in the history of the game and all that. But one of the things I think that I told my audience last night, and I'd like you to see if you concur with me or not, is I think it's at this point, especially with money being the central component that is going to be discussed, and the Players Association has always been strong. Although I will add this, Jay, I spoke to someone, an individual who is well embedded in the Major League Baseball community and has been for a long time before the show last night, and he told me that under Tony Clark's leadership as the director of the Major League Baseball Players Association, that the Players Association is not as unified right now as it has been in years gone by, and that there's a lot of guys that want to get back on the field and who would be willing to take something this year rather than nothing. And so there could be infighting within the players' union. Maybe the owner sensed that. But the overriding thing that I wanted my audience to know last night, at least in my opinion, for as much optimism and enthusiasm as we think or baseball fans are hoping for in terms of getting the games back on the field in some form or fashion this year, based on the money, and again, I agree with you, but based on the money, I would say it's no better than 50-50 that this thing eventually comes to fruition.
Well, you can't have a split here. You can't have a baseball season where some guys come back and some don't, or else it's not a realistic season. And Dino, the health risks, Mike Trout, the greatest player in the game, already has said, my wife is pregnant. She's due in August. What am I supposed to do? Leave the team, go into quarantine? Well, think about the competitive compromise there. Suddenly, the Angels, this is only an 82-game season to begin with, are going to be without Mike Trout for probably 4 weeks. I don't even know how the quarantine would work. If you're without him for 4 weeks, why are the Angels playing a season, 82-game season? That's what I'm talking about. There are going to be all these side hooks that come up that people haven't even thought about. Kershaw has said, I'm not leaving my family. Remember, we have a country that is divided by the coronavirus in the sense that in Atlanta, I expect the ballpark to be open. But in California, I do not expect 5 ballparks to be open for a long time. So how do you tell the Giants, A's, Dodgers, Angels, and Padres, all right, guys, you're going to do road games for 5 months in Arizona. Say goodbye to your families, and, oh, you might catch the virus while you're gone. And how can you do that? We're going to have these 5 teams going here and playing. It's not doable, Dino. Is it worth? Why are we doing it? Why is it worth it?
So then,
people aren't even watching baseball. I mean, my God, we've had years of plummeting TV ratings to hear people out there, oh, God, I'd do anything to see a baseball game. I don't know. Unless you're in Boston, Chicago, New York, or St. Louis, maybe L.A., really? I'm not seeing these ratings really skipping and jumping much in the last 20 years.
So then you would...
many problems in the sport... 3.5-hour games. We're in the 21st century. You have this sign-stealing scandal where, you know, the guilty players weren't even punished. The Astros were, the Red Sox weren't. You know, they juice balls, they de-juice balls. You know, they don't know how to market their stars. Nobody under 50 cares about it. I mean, where did it come into play here that baseball is going to provide this spiritual symbolic lift to the country? I think that's bullshit that baseball is spreading. Yeah, I would love to watch a cool baseball game right now. Dino, it's not going to be a cool baseball game. Nobody's going to be in the stands. You'll have no palpable energy. These guys aren't going to be in shape. Some of the greatest players will not play. They're too rich to take health risks. So it's just going to be this semi-style version of baseball, and it's going to be 82 games. Do we really need it? If you're a purist who really cares about the game, I think you're going to sit back and think long and hard about whether or not this is truly what you want to watch for 4 or 5 months in 2020.
So then I was being optimistic, I think, when I say it's 50-50. You would think that it's even less than that, obviously, but based on what you just said.
Because if I'm a player, and I've seen Sean Doolittle and Alex Wood and any number of players come out and where are the testing protocols here? All anybody wants to hear about is, how am I going to feel safe in this quarantine situation you're going to do in all these ballparks? They haven't laid it out yet. I hope they have by now, But when you're coming at these players publicly with 50-50 splits right out of the chute, and a player has a wife or a girlfriend at home, or maybe small children, and he gets home and they say, well, what? How are you going to stay safe? And he goes, I have no idea how I'm going to stay safe. Then how are you going to gain any sort of consensus about safety when the owners are wrapped up in money issues? So, no, I think be careful. You know, you're a smart guy. Propaganda, they're spinning it where? ESPN, that's their partner. Whatever, try to read credible sources. The problem is right now, The Athletic is in bed with baseball. Most of the local newspapers are in bed with baseball. As I said, ESPN is in bed with baseball. Everybody wants baseball back. Fox wants baseball back. And then you're going to get positive spins. But if you're looking at this as a realist, just think deeply about what truly has to happen, the layers and layers of situations they have to get over to be able to even think about having a season.
I guess your feelings would be consistent with the NFL as well, because the NFL, of course, announced the schedule last week, and then they held the draft. It went off without a hitch, and the NFL is going full bore here. They say they're going to have a full season. The contingencies are in place to make the schedule flexible in case they've got to stop here and they've got to stop there. The thing that I think about, Jay, and I want sports back as much as anybody does, but the thing that I think about is what is going to happen. And I think I've made this comment to you before, or I've asked this question openly. You know, what's going to happen when somebody does test positive, or if, as a plane is landing on my roof here, but if somebody does test positive, a manager, a coach, a star quarterback, I mean, does that mean that the player is going to go into, I hope that means that if they're going to start, that the player would then go into quarantine for 2 weeks or whatever it is, and they wouldn't have to shut down the entire mechanism of whatever league gets going first. That's an unanswered question at this point. I don't think that's been addressed. What happens if a player does test positive? In the event that a player tests positive, what does it mean? Do you pivot to what direction at that point?
Yeah, because if you're reopening a restaurant, Dino, you can take tables out of the restaurant and create social distancing 10 feet apart or whatever. Same goes for certain department stores, whatever you're doing. You cannot change the mechanism of a line of scrimmage. Here they are, within inches of each other, huffing and puffing and sweating and coughing. And what? Of course, as Fauci said the other day, that you're going to have a spread of coronavirus, especially if there's a second wave coming. You know, I would love to get to September and we don't have a second wave and everything is returned to normal and we can watch an NFL game. That is just stupid to even think that. So foolhardy, given what we've gone through and what we might go through again. We're dealing with, as I said before, different areas of the country are more conducive to starting up sports than other places, such as where I live. But for it to be the National Football League, everybody's got to be on the same page. You can't start the Atlanta Falcons and, the Minnesota Vikings at a different time than the L.A. Rams and the New York Giants. You just can't do that and have a realistic NFL season. It's just common sense at some point. And testing is so vital. I'm not hearing anything from the NFL about testing. You know why, Dino? It's an ultra-sensitive topic when so many hospitals, laboratories, nursing homes have shortages of testing. The last thing any of these leagues wants to do right now is to have the appearance of hoarding tests. Now, they can go buy these tests privately, but there's still a supply shortage, you know? So the problem is, whatever is going to baseball, and do the math, you're going to have so many tests with so many people. Same for the NBA, the NFL. Just do the math, not just players and coaches, but support staff and everybody imaginable. How many tests are you taking away from the national supply? So these answers that the baseball players want, they're not going to get them, because I think baseball is petrified to go public with, oh, we'll get our hands on them, don't worry. Then you've got the medical community firing it at baseball for being greedy. It's, Dino, we could talk all night about the problems of bringing this back. We can either take a romantic view of it and say, Come on, we're going to be positive. Don't be this germophobic idiot. It's coming back, and we're going to have our sports back. Well, I happen to think that's unrealistic, and it's pie in the sky, and it's kind of Mr. Rogers-like. I'm more on the other end. I'm a realistic guy, always have been. And if it comes back, I'll be the first one probably in front of the TV. But, you know, we are so far away from that, it's probably not even worth talking about.
Right, getting back to Jeff Passan on ESPN, his story that was on their website, I don't know if you saw it yesterday, he talked about some teams, the agents going insolvent because they can't collect their commissions. So obviously they've got a vested interest in this. They want to see the game back on the field as soon as possible. And he also mentioned that with the, especially you would have to think, Jay, the mid-market, the small-market teams, particularly those teams that can't rely on the dollars that are generated by having your own television network, the Yankees and the Mets and the Dodgers and the Cubs with the marquee network that's going to someday we think is going to get on the air. But he was talking about some of these mid-market and small-market teams possibly filing for bankruptcy, if you can believe it or not.
Well, I'm hearing the Cubs because they opened, I don't know if you've been to Wrigley Field lately, but Ricketts has built a mini city around Wrigley Field, a hotel, restaurants. And because nobody is going to games, Dino, he's taking a bath. So the rumor is that he's going to dump Chris Bryant and maybe Rizzo, and they're going to start from scratch. That's the other thing here. The pandemic is going to hit certain franchises, not all middle market franchises either, some big ones, simply because their revenues are not coming in right now. And so that's what you have to think about as well. How, as it is, the gulf between the haves and the have-nots is so wide in baseball. Now it's going to become even wider. People, they do rely on fans to some degree. How are you going to decide how to split revenues? As it is right now, the broadcast revenues are split among the 30 teams. You're not going to have that revenue coming in through the turnstiles now. Is that, without having that added turnstile money, is that going to put some teams almost on the brink of going out of business? Are the Pittsburgh Pirates, a team that already is laying off all kinds of people in the front office, are they doomed to expire here? I mean, some of these teams, Tampa Bay, these teams that just kind of hang on, Oakland, are they going to survive this? I think those are fair questions. I wish baseball would think about that a little more than these 50-50 splits, but I do understand this part of it, Dino. If baseball does go away this year with a looming labor impasse at the end of next season, this sport will have zero momentum going into next spring, and I think they're petrified at all the money that could be lost. So they're just trying to gain a little bit back this season, but they're doing it at the expense of health risks that players have to take. It's a rotten shame, but baseball, I think of all the sports, has the existential crisis on its hands, and you wonder about its future. I think the NBA has a future, and I know the NFL has a future. I do wonder about baseball with all the problems going into this, now the pandemic on top of it. How does it come out in the wash?
Well, and not only the arguing over money right now, but also let's throw into the stew pot that the current collective bargaining agreement expires after the 2021 season. And I was told, again, by the same individual that I spoke with yesterday, who's a well-embedded person in the Major League Baseball community, that the owners this time are set, and they're determined to add baseball to the roles of sports leagues, Jay, that operate under a salary cap system. So baseball, you're right. I mean, they're in a very precarious situation now. They could be in an even more precarious situation, a short time ahead as far as the labor agreement with the players. And we've had, 25 years of unprecedented, nothing in the way of work stoppages or strikes or things like that. But the game is very vulnerable right now in a number of different ways. So,
it's been kept together by TV. But where do you think ESPN is going to put its money in the next round of negotiations? It's going to have to spend up for the NFL to try to wedge into that Super Bowl rotation and get better Monday Night Football fare. ESPN is going to have to take some of that baseball money, and they're ailing as it is, ESPN, and put it into the NFL. And by the way, those Goodell negotiations will happen this year. The NFL knows what it is, and will demand high prices from everybody. So it's left to Fox and Turner to carry baseball? Do you think Fox wants to keep paying out the ass for baseball when every World Series is rated lower than the previous one and the average age of every World Series viewer goes up a year to 59 or 60 every year? I mean, that doesn't hit any of the demographics they want. Why would Fox keep supporting the future of baseball? Turner is just a minor player in this. All these regional networks, Dino, they're struggling. Disney tried to sell those in a bundle, and nobody wanted them last year. Now look at them. Regional network supported by baseball that isn't being played. So they're in trouble. I mean, just we haven't even... I think everybody is numb right now. All our minds are sort of numb. But if you sit back and think about this and let the mind roll a little bit about the economy of sports, the, what is it, $200 billion industry of sports in America, it's unraveling. And I'm not overstating it. It's unraveling. Why do you think, Dino, everybody's in a mad rush to get back, get back, get back? So what if a player tests positive? So what if a player tests positive? We're in the apocalypse right now. What can I say? I didn't think I'd ever live it, but we seem to be in it. I'm rooting for us to get out of it, but somebody's going to have to give me some real medical evidence we're getting out of it.
Let's get back to the virus itself. The country of South Korea, I know you had some thoughts on that.
Well, everybody thought they were back. Seoul, South Korea didn't have a single transmitted case over a number of weeks. So they sent everybody back to school, everybody back to work, and sports resumed, as we've seen on ESPN these nights. But some ding-a-ling decided, we're going to reopen the nightclubs and the bars. And a 29-year-old male during the holidays recently contracted the virus, and now the city is shutting down and the country is in disarray. All it takes is one positive test. Now there are more than 100 people who have tested positive who were linked to this guy. Everything is shut down again. This is called the second wave of the coronavirus that Fauci keeps talking about. Nobody wants to listen to him, including Trump. It's happening right now in South Korea, which has been hailed as the one country that beat the coronavirus. No, it did not. So I don't even know, Dino, if we're going to have these games at 1 o'clock in the morning anymore.
We've talked about the NFL. We'll talk about the NBA. Baseball, of course, we just got done talking about that. The NHL is in the mix as well. But one thing we haven't talked about is the upcoming college football season. And, of course, all campuses are vacant, don't have any students, you know, on campus right now, and the spring football has been eliminated. You talk about losing your ass, Jay. I mean, with the way that these athletic departments, you know, produce so much revenue, especially these big football factory schools and the five major conferences, most of them, you wonder if college football is going to be able to find any way forward in terms of putting their own games back on the field come fall.
Well, if you don't have students on campus, you can't have student athletes on campus.
Right.
And Mark Emmert said that. Now, granted, the NCAA does not run college football. It's a separate deal. I suppose, Dino, if enough superpowers wanted to get together and stage a season in places that have not been hit hard by the coronavirus, I suppose you could get Georgia, Alabama, the craziness going on in Florida with their governor. I'm sure you'd get the University of Florida involved. Maybe LSU, although New Orleans was hammered. Maybe Texas. No, you can get those, but nobody out here. You can't have a Pac-12 season if as we're hearing, the University of California system is going to shut down campuses. Well, throw out Cal and throw out UCLA. They're not going to be playing. It could be a very uneven landscape where you have just Ohio State, maybe. If you have enough testing and if enough parents want their kids going through this when these kids aren't being paid to play football, I suppose you can, you know, find enough schools, programs to cobble together a college football season. But again, how many players are going to do it? How many are going to be fearful? Everybody's forgetting the athletes in this equation. Yeah, we can do college football. Have you asked Trevor Lawrence? Have you asked Justin Fields? Why would they risk their NFL futures by testing positive for the coronavirus and spreading it throughout a team, perhaps. It's just unrealistic, all of this. I hate to be the negative nabob here, but I'm just trying to be realistic. It just doesn't make any sense unless we have some sort of miracle cure. Maybe that'll happen over the next couple of months. I don't see how you could play college football.
Do you know anyone personally in your close circle of friends or associates or colleagues or acquaintances who has the virus?
No, thank God. I don't, and I keep telling people I know. You know, I have older parents. I have, I mean, I'm fairly old myself. I mean, you know, you have to think about these things, and you should see me out in the street. I've got three masks on at a time, and I'm the germaphobe. Anytime I see a pack of Pelotoners coming by without masks, I always sort of scream at them, idiots. But to answer your question, but that could change tomorrow. How about you? Do you know anyone?
No, I don't know anyone. I don't know anyone who also knows anyone who has the virus. One last thing for you before we say goodbye tonight, Jay, and it's Jay Mariotti with me here. This is off the beaten track, but since we were talking about college athletics, and I've never asked you this, everybody's got a different opinion, although I'm not sure any formula has been so definitive as to say it's workable. But when it comes to college athletes, when it comes to these big revenue-producing schools, and we talk about the main drivers of revenue as far as college athletics is concerned being football programs and basketball programs, in your opinion, and I'm sure that you've been asked this before, maybe you've even written about it or spoken about it on radio shows previously, but in your opinion, should college athletes be paid? Should they be compensated in some way, in some form or fashion? Can they, in your opinion?
If they are prominent enough to benefit from likenesses, commercials, speaking engagements, yes.
I agree there.
That creates such a mess. How would you do that? What do you pay the punter or the second string tight end? How do you do that? I think it's odd, but during a pandemic, the NCAA actually has been addressing this. Now, let's see if they voted in January. That's another thing. But I've come around on this. I used to think 15, 20 years ago, you're getting that room and board and tuition and that college education and all those connections you make as a major athlete at a university for life, these connections business-wise for life. Don't take that for granted. Then I saw how the pot from television networks became exceedingly high, disgustingly high, and you know what, a billion a year for March Madness, CBS, to the NCAA and the universities. And I started to think this is disgraceful that the star of March Madness isn't paid a penny. So yeah, I think that if Baker Mayfield in Norman, Oklahoma is offered a car ad, he should do the car ad. Unfortunately, the concern is a third-party agent might then ask the car dealer, Baker needs a car. Can you give it to him? Wink, wink on the side. That's going to be the hang-up, Dino. You're going to have third parties coming in representing these athletes. What kind of under-the-table payments are going to be made? It's not as simple as, yes, pay the player.
Yeah, no, I'm in agreement with you in terms of likeness and image and under a situation in which somebody does an advertisement for a local car dealership. If it's done the right way, I think that the players should be able to take advantage of a system like that. But, it's a very complicated overall sort of a thing to try to figure out how you're going to compensate players in terms of actually paying them and making them employees. And then we get into the whole amateur versus professional thing. And it's so nobody's ever come up with an idea that I've thought about it. I've banged my head against the wall for years trying to figure out how they could do this, and I, you know, in the end, I think it's impossible. So,
well, I'll tell you what, college basketball is dying. See, the NBA has figured out the G League, and they're going to be pouring more money into that again when we get back to playing. But you're going to see more and more players. We've seen a few blue chip recruits just completely circumvent.
Yeah.
Even thinking about going to college, they're going to go right to the G League, or they go play in other countries. College basketball is on the free fall here, and we see now Mike Krzyzewski in his imperial reign, perhaps sullied here if Duke paid Zion Williamson, and Bill Self being condemned by the NCAA as an egregious violator of rules. I mean, it's this cesspool of college basketball is coinciding with players just saying the hell with college basketball. So I think that could be the one sport you might not even recognize coming back. And there's CBS with this gigantic bill of $1 billion a year for March Madness when you're not going to be getting, after the one-and-done thing is over in a couple of years, you're not going to be getting any big-time freshman players playing in March. So it's college hoops, I think, is in deep, deep trouble.
Jay, always good. Another great hour in the books. And, well, we do it again next week. Looking forward to it already, my friend.
Me too, and I'm going to go blow my nose and hope I don't have the coronavirus.
So all right, Jay.
Next week.
Take care, buddy. That's the great Jay Mariotti on the Dino Costa Show every Wednesday. He comes on in hour number two, and that's what we do. We just, throw it around, and who knows where it's going to go. And there's Jay. Another appearance by him. Good stuff. All right, actually, we've bled in to hour number three already. How about that? We're in the third hour already. I'm sensing overtime on the show tonight.